Hello and welcome to episode 142 of Unofficial Partner, the Sports Business Podcast. I'm Richard Gillis. Today's conversation is about the role of agencies in helping clients be culturally relevant in fans' lives across sport, music and esports. And we ask why some brands seem to be able to bridge that cultural divide and some don't. Our guests are Richard Adelsberg and Owen Lafferty from the independent creative agency Ear to the Ground, where something seems to be going right. Despite the pandemic and the widespread cancellation of sport, Ear to the Ground has had a stellar year, tripling profits and broadening its client portfolio that includes New Balance, Sony PS5, StatSports and Therabody, the performance tech brand. If you like the Unofficial Partner podcasts, you'll really like our weekly newsletter, which is read by thousands of people across the global sports business, and where we talk about the topics and themes that arise from our podcast conversations. We can send it direct to your inbox every Thursday. All you have to do is sign up via unofficialpartner.com, where you'll also find our back catalogue of podcasts. Let's start with just a conversation about where we are today. So I knew about, or I heard about Ear to the Ground a few years ago, and then you got on the Sport Industry Awards shortlist, which then I thought, oh, okay, well, this is an interesting sort of agency story. I didn't know much about you, so, and I probably listeners will come to us and say, okay, I've heard of them, but I want to know more. So just give us a bit of, let's have a couple of minutes on the backstory. When did it start, and, you know, who are you?
Oh, okay. Where do we start? So I think a lot of people might say this, but we have got a fairly or pretty unique story or journey as an agency or a business. We were founded kind of way back about 15 years ago, maybe 20 years ago now, born out of the music industry, actually. And we originally came to life producing, promoting some of the biggest music festivals around Europe. So you might know Kendall Calling, Parklife, Festival Number 6, Snowbombing in Austria. They were actually Ear to the Ground festivals, and that was where the business was formed. And essentially we were producing those music festivals, but we were also promoting them, selling them out, and selling hundreds of thousands of tickets to music fans around the world, around Europe. As such, we kind of started getting quite a bit of intelligence around music audiences and fan bases, and really knowing how they move and where they go and how you can influence them. And quite quickly from that, we started employing marketeers and built a bit of an agency around the music industry, and started selling our services to brands away from the festival field and more broadly to brands, businesses that wanted to sell products or kind of increase their brand presence with music audiences. And we essentially were a music agency, but we had this separate side of the business that was in the festival fields, getting our knees muddy and putting stages up and putting on some of the biggest music artists from around the world. So we had this kind of dual meaning and dual purpose, I suppose, as a business. After a few years, it can be quite apparent that actually those two businesses weren't necessarily making sense to sit that closely together. So we actually demerged at that point. Festival side of the business went one way, and Ear to the Ground, the full service marketing agency, I suppose, was born. That was about 7 or 8 years ago now. As we started doing more high profile work with big brands like Samsung, Coca-Cola, loads of those kind of big blue chip brands, we started getting noticed by the sports industry. And I think, you know, being a fairly traditional kind of industry, I think it's fair to say with a lot of traditional agencies, some of the more progressive, ambitious brands in the sports industry started coming, wanting to speak to us and thinking we were quite cool is probably a very basic way of putting it. And we were doing cool work in the music industry. So the likes of Nike, Beats by Dre, people like that, that had crossed over into music, but also had a big presence in sport. So we started delivering and working with some of those great brands that kind of crossed that worlds of sport and music quite naturally. Fast forward to where we are now, and the sport side of the business has just kind of exploded, I suppose, in the last 4 or 5 years. And now everything that we do as a business is around either sports or esports. So yeah, working with the likes of PlayStation, New Balance. We've worked with Nike for 7 or 8 years, UEFA, FIFA, a number of sports tech brands. But essentially everything that we do now is still around kind of leading culture and influencing culture, but using sport or esports to do that.
It's interesting you say about the you know, the traditional sports agency model. How would you define that? Because that's a term that gets used quite a lot. And question here also about the difference between a music agency and a sports agency. But what? How would you sort of define what a traditional sports agency is?
There's different ways of explaining it, and different agencies will fall into that bracket of traditional sports agency kind of, I guess, terminology. But from our point of view, the like when we started looking at the sports industry 7, 8, 9 years ago, we just felt that everything was being done the same. There wasn't many risks being taken. There wasn't a huge amount of ambition with the campaigns or marketing. And we were so aware at that point that obviously, you know, these footballers, these sports stars, they are such valuable assets. And what they do on the pitch is the most important thing for the vast majority of people that surround them. But we just felt there was a huge untapped opportunity creatively, from a media and a channel perspective with these people as well, to actually take them into places that maybe it wasn't being explored particularly well with some of the more traditional agencies that might be looking at it on a more of a practical level in terms of kind of eyeballs and media perspective, when actually creatively we felt there was a load of areas that we could take sport that maybe learned from the music industry that was maybe slightly less regulated or less traditional in its approach to marketing, I suppose.
Yeah, Owen, what's your view?
I think like the background that Rich kind of took you through there, that has a big impact on, I think, why we'd kind of view ourselves as not the same as maybe traditional sports agencies, where they've maybe grown out of, you know, being founded within the sports industry and, you know, building all of their work based on the knowledge of how rights holders and brands have always maybe worked together, and almost maybe within, you know, that kind of framing their approach and mindset. Whereas ours has definitely kind of come in, you know, viewing sport from the very beginning through the wider prism of culture, and, you know, the impact of sport in culture, and that being kind of the lens that we kind of approached everything through. And then that shaping how we recruited people as well. So not necessarily just recruiting people because they had a great understanding, or only because they maybe had a great understanding of, you know, sports sponsorship rights, or, you know, yeah, how to build campaigns that would work from a kind of brand and broadcast model, but how to build campaigns that would impact and lead culture. That lens, those were kind of how we looking at how we bring people into the business. And then that then translated, I guess, into how we built the model from there, is because, you know, we were looking at the industry slightly differently, and you know, we were kind of, I guess, held different things to value. And again, it's not so much about the scale of sport, but it was about the impact on culture and how it crossed over with fashion and how it could cross over with music, and how you could take learning from those places. That then started to shape, I think, how we then grew the business since then as well. And that's kind of built the model that we've got today, you know, kind of almost came from that thread and that view.
I'm wondering if the industry that it serves shapes the agency market in a way, because actually Rich mentioned there that sport is more regulated. There are bigger and more global rights holders and they are all about control of assets, and they're further down that road. And obviously music has its own dynamic, as does esports, again, different again. What an agency can achieve, or its ability to sort of bring creativity into play, is in some way shaped by the industry it's serving, isn't it? Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, certainly to a great degree, but I think we're seeing now that in the last, you know, particularly in the last 12 months, the whole industry has flipped on its head. And, you know, obviously we're all very aware of influencers and how they existed within sport and music to some degree as well. But we've just seen an explosion in players, professional players who previously have been getting media trained and not being able to talk in their own tone of voice or language. We're working with players now who are desperately coming to kind of people like us and agencies like us saying, we want to be seen in this light. We want to have our own brand. We want to be seen by audiences in the way that influencers are. And actually, we want to get closer to the audiences that we'd come totally, totally distant to as well. So although it certainly is a massive degree kind of influenced by the rights holders and the control they've got, there's a huge, huge kind of uprising, I would say, amongst those more intelligent, outgoing, charismatic players that want to create their own brand. And they're starting to do that. Whereas, you know, 5 years ago, it wasn't happening. But now the value of creating your own channel and creating your own brand has been obviously seen by kind of agents and those players that are a little bit more proactive in trying to do that. So we're starting to see quite a big shift. And I think the issues of the pandemic have accelerated a lot of that, I think, for sure.
Yeah, there is definitely, because, that athlete story is such a key pillar of it. And that's representative of, there's like this democratization, right, of what it means to be a participant or to have a career in sport that maybe we haven't seen in the past. Like, there are so many other different avenues through which you can have a career in sport, and you can influence that, the industry, and you can influence audiences, and you can participate, essentially, be that as a designer or as a broadcaster or as a media channel or, as an alternative athlete. There's people who are kind of building careers on social media channels and they aren't participating as professionals. So that in itself just creates all of these different access points for brands, which then obviously facilitates different approaches to creativity, right? Where it's not maybe labored around the same historical kind of rights that have existed in the marketplace. That means you can, build new things or try new things because the talent has totally changed.
Let's talk then. You've used a couple of times cultural relevance. It is a nice term. I just need it defined a bit. So what does it mean?
I get, before we go into the definition of cultural relevance, I think there's a really important point to make around listening. And we've got this real founding belief that the world itself, and I'm appreciating the irony of this as I'm talking on a sports podcast, but the world itself, but certainly our industry, just doesn't listen very well. And we've been so aware of that. And the business that we founded kind of 15 years ago was born on the principle of leading culture through the power of listening. At that point, we were listening to the latest musicians, the latest artists that were breaking through and putting them on a music stage. But now we're actually, in a much more intelligent way through fan intelligence, listening to what sports audiences really care about. And, time and time again, whether it's kind of rights holders or brands, we're just seeing, and agencies as well, we just don't think there's much listening going on to these people that really matter and you're really trying to influence and engage at the end of the day. And for us, when through our process of listening through fan intelligence, cultural relevance and what cultural relevance means and how brands are kind of sitting within that bracket of cultural relevance has come up time and time again as the most important thing that particularly youth sports audiences are demanding of brands and rights holders and demanding of kind of how they behave and how they act. So I guess just to take it before, I think Owen's going to probably have an amazing explanation of definition of what cultural relevance is, but just to take it back a couple of stages, like from our point of view, cultural relevance is only important because of this process of listening and actually understanding what matters to the audiences that we're trying to engage with and trying to influence. And time and time again, cultural relevance is the sort of overarching point. And there's a number of things that kind of sit within that that like are just so important that we don't think that brands or rights holders are kind of listening to at the moment or understanding.
Well, it better be good, this definition, Owen. You've been
Unfortunately, my first point on it is that we've obviously done a piece of research, not obviously, but we've done a piece of research digging into it. This point of cultural relevance and what it means for a brand to be culturally relevant. And the reason that we did it, like one of the fundamental reasons was because, we were kind of being briefed and being tasked with building brands' cultural relevance in lots of different ways within the industry. And it was being spoken about so much as it's really important for brands to be culturally relevant. Like it was like a founding conversation. It was a central pillar of conversations that we were having repeatedly in the industry with clients internally. And it was kind of like a moment where, everybody kind of vaguely knew that cultural relevance was about a brand, being of the moment and kind of connecting to people at a particular point in time. There's a lot of loose chat around it. And it was our realization that actually, there's a lot of briefs out there and brands are trying to be culturally relevant, but where is the central definition and where is this point? So we did a piece of research, which was originally going to be ranking, a kind of insight study, understanding which brands were culturally relevant. But we ended up spending the first half of it landing on a definition on actually what it meant for a brand to be culturally relevant before we could then go into like ranking brands against it. So it's a really good question because fundamentally it's one that, it's a phrase that's been thrown around and we then asked ourselves it and, looking But after a bit of navel gazing, realized that we had to do a bit of kind of insight work to dig into that. So we did a study where we kind of dug into what, you know, cultural relevance means. The kind of the definition that we landed on, because fundamentally to us, there are kind of six characteristics that make up a brand's kind of cultural relevance. And the definition we landed on was a culturally relevant brand is a brand that, you know, leads culture, drives positive change, across sport, and through that builds connection with kind of young audiences. It's all about leading what's happening within culture, driving positive change within that space, and connecting with audiences. Like, that is fundamentally, you know, what we see as at the heart of what a culturally relevant brand is. And within that, there were six characteristics that kind of came up through this piece of audience research, through kind of our fan intelligence network, which I know we'll talk about. But within it, there were the fact that culturally relevant brand drives positive change. So within sport, a culturally relevant brand will drive positive change and cause action that improves, you know, sport and society through what they do, through the things that they do, their behaviors, and that they disrupt the norm. So a culturally relevant brand, you know, changes what is happening within sport, you know, brings innovation to the table, be that through product, culture, the culture of the organization, or through kind of the way it communicates.
Let's have a few sort of examples then. Who are we thinking about here in terms of on the brand side?
So it's really interesting. So yeah, we did this study, and the brand that kind of top scored for 2020 on the most culturally relevant brands was Adidas. And I guess kind of one of the key things that came through for them as a brand that was really, really interesting, was their ability to kind of join together what they spoke about that they cared about, which was, you know, the planet and improving kind of equality, diversity, but then also sustainability and where the planet was going. And then that played all the way through into their marketing comms, but then also the products that they were kind of delivering. So they as a brand kind of really lived that, because they spoke about what they believed in and then delivered on that in terms of the way they built their organization, but then also the products that they were kind of pulling through. They were one of the brands that scored particularly well within it. I'm trying to riff off the top of my head some of the other ones that did well. There were a couple of rights holders that the kind of the audience saw as brands that were particularly culturally relevant. And it's really interesting, in the year that was 2020, the NBA kind of absolutely outscored all of the others. And again, that was like there was a ream of things that kind of, I guess, kind of built that up. And there was what they were doing from a kind of social justice perspective and creating a platform for players and ambassadors to kind of talk about the things that cared about them. So driving positive change and standing for something. There was the fact that they, you know, celebrated sports heritage and had a real relevance in sports heritage, which I guess kind of people played to the fact that The Last Dance was kind of created as a content series last year. And that built like a bit of people really understanding that the NBA had real sports heritage, and that mattered to them seeing a brand as culturally relevant. And then disrupting the norm, you know, audiences massively appreciate what the NBA have kind of done from a sports tech perspective in terms of, yeah, how they've kind of innovated the way they bring the product to the table, but then also, you know, almost just how they pivoted in what happened last year and were able to finish the season in the bubble in Florida. So those types of actions are things, you know, in terms of, as you said, the social justice platform that they created, the content series and how that celebrated heritage, and then also, you know, the way they've kind of innovated from a tech and kind of viewing perspective, and then also the bubble. Those are kind of the types of things that the audience really loved NBA for and seen as that's what made them culturally relevant.
I think on the flip side as well, the brands that maybe didn't do quite so well, like, it became really apparent that brands that were really standing for something and driving positive change, that was the key metric that people thought was the most important thing in making a brand culturally relevant, whether you stood for something and drove positive change. And interestingly, throughout all the brands that we profiled and looked at, that was the weakest scoring element throughout the whole study for each of those brands as well. So although it was the most important for the audience, they weren't necessarily seeing many brands that were actually kind of following through and delivering on that promise that they might make and actually having some substance behind some, you know, whether it was a Black Lives Matter social post or whether it's something around COVID-19, there might be kind of on the face of it, statements made by the brand. But then, you know, audiences are now calling out those brands if they don't sort of follow through with action based on those statements. And we're seeing it time and time again that actually that's possibly the area that brands are scoring the weakest in, just because you know, they don't necessarily want to be seen as having making political statements or getting involved in some things that are, you know, fairly contentious or, you know, heated areas and subject matter. But audiences are demanding that as well. And if you don't stand for something and sort of see it through as a brand, in terms of cultural relevance, we're really seeing those brands and rights holders getting called out by particularly kind of these credible, culturally credible youth audiences.
Let's talk about listening, just because you mentioned it earlier. I guess my question is whether fans know what they want. Because obviously the opposite view is that they are innately conservative and they dislike new things and have to be taken along a journey towards new formats, new ways of doing things. And then in the end up, they may like them and love them. But the sort of history of the sports industry particularly is that initial resistance from fans. So yeah, I'm trying to balance listening to them, but also knowing that they won't want what I'm selling them or presenting to them.
There's a couple of points on that. So first of all, part of our fan intelligence process, we'll probably talk a bit more about shortly. We're not just speaking to kind of everyday fans and audiences and more traditional fans that certainly fall into the bracket that maybe you're referencing there. Like as a business, all we're doing from a brand point of view is talking to audiences that maybe don't sit in that traditional fan base model. They're maybe the kind of new, younger audiences that actually we're seeing are a lot more open to change and a lot more kind of wanting to rip up the rule book and engage with sports and teams and players in a way that is maybe totally different to traditional audiences. But just to strip it back to, I guess, do fans know what they want? The fans that we're talking to as part of this fan intelligence process are those influential fans that are actually understanding audiences and influencing them on a daily basis. So it might be a musician that lives in Nigeria that actually has a total grasp of Nigerian football culture, but their day job's a musician. So they're not kind of your average kind of bloke in the stands of a football match, your traditional fan. They're people that are influencing change, are understanding trends, and are essentially driving new behaviours amongst fan bases and audiences that kind of brands are trying to get to, which is, you know, a big reason why I suppose we don't work directly with rights holders particularly anymore. Because as the business model's evolved, we're working more and more with brands that are desperate to try and get with that kind of young audience that are seeing like the old traditional ways and consumption habits of sports fans as quite archaic and not something that they'd associate with themselves. So Fan Intelligence, it's a digital platform that we've built and owned. And it's based around a group, a network of people, 11,000, growing just over 11,000 now. And we call them the most culturally influential fans around the world. So as I mentioned before, it might be musicians, fashion designers, producers, content creators, activists, esports players, gamers, people that are influencing and understanding culture around fan bases around the world. So we've built this network of 11,000 people over the last kind of 4, 5, 6 years. They're all housed on a digital platform that we call Fan Intelligence. And we have access to these people on a daily basis. Then they help us collaborate. We collaborate with them. We listen to them and we collaborate them on all our client briefs. So every single brief that we get, we'll look at our network of 11,000 fans, and there's a geographic split across the world. A really good one going from kind of North America to Africa, Asia, all over Europe, and South America, everywhere in between. We'll pick the right group of people from the network that understand or influence the fan base that our clients are trying to hit. And we'll collaborate and we'll listen and collaborate to those with those people to understand the right insights to how we're going to get to kind of the answer. But then also from a co-creation point of view, when we're getting into the creative side of things, we'll work with them on creative. So we have virtual creative sessions and workshops with people, and it's amazing. You'll have our creative director fronting it, and there'll be, let's say, a musician from Paris, there'll be kind of a street basketball player, there'll be a designer. All these people will be brought into a co-creation space led by our strategy director or creative director, and we'll bounce ideas off them, we'll develop concepts, and essentially we'll bring those people that understand the audience we're trying to hit into our whole process.
What's in it for them in terms of the 11,000 people on the other side of that? I can see from your point of view the upside, but what's the upside for them?
So, I mean, we have an incentivization program that runs alongside it, essentially, where we, you know, based on their level of involvement, they get, you know, they're kind of incentivized to take part. You know, a basic way of describing a similar approach would be, you know, whenever you have focus groups and people are provided with an incentive to take part, it's a very, you know, we have a similar-ish model to that. And it's managed by, I mean, it's funny, we used to have it managed because of where it came from. The network used to be managed by like our insight team and our insight leads, who were obviously fantastic at having conversations and listening to these guys and pulling out the gold, but maybe weren't the right personality types to manage the relationships and the network on an ongoing basis to make sure that everybody was, you know, kept engaged and being used at the right time. So we've kind of flipped that a bit, and it's managed by people with a CRM background. We made some hires with people kind of a CRM background, and they manage the network like you would a CRM database. So essentially they're making sure that people are managed, used on the kind of appropriate briefs, and that they're, you know, kind of, that they're all, they're kind of happy and looked after in the right way. So we have a baseline where there's a strong relationship that the CRM managers kind of have in place. And then if they're on a project base, there's, you know, vouchers essentially to kind of take part in certain projects to collaborate. And then monthly and kind of quarterly or at key moments, because of relationships that we've got, then there's further incentivization through maybe kind of product gifting or tickets and experiences. But I guess, you know, kind of the fundamental, one of the fundamental things as well, you know, kind of beyond the incentivization based on what they're taking part in, they are generally talking about and contributing to something that they really love talking about as well. So it's not like we're kind of drawing really kind of painful conversations out of them. You know, we've built, you know, one of the collectives that we've built within the network is called the Future Football Collective. And that is, you know, a forum for these guys to be discussing the direction of where the sport goes, and, you know, what future opportunities there might be. And they're contributing, you know, really directly to everything from maybe where products go to where brands go and what they do, to what the opportunities might be with talent. So that's a conversation that they're really invested in and interested in having. And then obviously we look, you know, we make sure that everybody's incentivized appropriately so that, you know, nothing's being taken advantage of, but they are really, you know, enthused to take part in generally in the model. Not every conversation is, you know, a brilliant one in terms of sometimes it's quite challenging because they're talking about a topic that maybe they're not happy with, but the general broad idea of contributing to the direction of where everything's going is something they're interested in. Yeah. So that's what's in it for them.
There are, as you will be more than aware, a number of models out there which will scrape social media chatter and claim to do so, or come out with an outcome that's similar. I mean, I've seen people, other agencies, and present, these are cultural trends. This is the evidence because, look, we've dragged everything off Twitter and done it that way. What's the advantage of doing it your way?
So, and that is, you know, and what you've just described is obviously a valid approach to getting an understanding of what's happening and maybe what's being said on social or where behaviours are. And, you know, we work with and use, you know, similar platforms and tools to help with our broad understanding. And that even helps us, you know, potentially highlight people that might, you know, come into the network. But in terms of, you know, fundamentally, we are a creative agency building kind of creative in the world of sport and esports. And that understanding of what is happening is useful, but digging into why it is and what people really care about and having those ongoing conversations tends to unlock, you know, those perspective, like a unique perspective, or shine a light on a unique, you know, essentially a unique insight that we can then pull out and start to build ideas or kind of even product development side of. The power of those conversations, that extra layer of depth that you get from that qualitative, you know, engagement is so powerful. And I guess, you know, to Richard's point, it's not like this is an upfront, we'll have a look at what's happening, and then that basic understanding is something that, well, not basic, but that understanding is something we'll riff off for quite a while. You know, as we iterate and as we move through our process, we can continue to go back and have conversations. And, you know, so you can, you know, when you get to a point that's like, well, why is this? Then you can have that conversation and sense check and road test. as you go. So it's not like you're running everything off that initial piece of work. It's there as a resource to continually go back to and sense check iterations and move along with it. My background is more insight and kind of, you know, kind of planning, and Rich is definitely, you know, from the creative and strategic approach. But, you know, within the worlds I've kind of worked through, you know, ethnography has obviously been something that people have harnessed in lots of different ways. And it's really powerful. It is expensive and time consuming. These people are almost doing ethnographic studies every day, and that they're living in these fan bases and watching what's happening and thinking about it all the time. And our conversations unlock what they've learned and unlock what they see and pull it in.
Can you just explain what that means, ethnographic?
That is kind of a classic research approach where you immerse yourself in a particular culture for a long period of time and study how people behave and how they engage with each other. You know, some of the most interesting, you know, kind of sociological theories have come from it, because it's about immersing yourself in a culture for a prolonged period of time and really listening and observing what people do in their natural, you know, in their natural, you know, habitat, essentially, and kind of really taking learnings from that. And it brings out real gold, but it does take a long period of time because you have to immerse yourself in that, and it's quite expensive. You know, it's been the foundation of some great, you know, ad campaigns in the past, but it does have its restrictions in terms of how frequently you can apply it. Whereas these people are immersed in it and are living it and are breathing it every day. And what we do from our approach is we tap into that, and you bring that through without the having to go off and, you know, live with like tennis fans in Oregon for 6 months to get a real understanding of how they engage with the sport and how they follow it.
Can you imagine?
So exactly.
The point you were making before, Richard, about traditional agencies, is this is probably quite a nice opportune moment to just bring to life an example of where we sort of sit quite differently to that traditional setup as well. So there's two points here. One around, like Owen's done a great job of explaining how we use the network and the relevance and how they're so immersed in the cultures and audiences. But for us, it's completely insane that there's a creative director or a strategy director in businesses and agencies as a traditional model that comes up with ideas for a whole host of brands across a whole host of sports, you know, cultural verticals, territories, regions, geographies, audiences. There's like a handful of creative directors that sit within a business, maybe at most, that come up with all the ideas. And maybe they speak to a few of their kind of people below them, but they essentially sit in a boardroom and just have a bit of desk-based research and then come up with some wild and wonderful ideas. Like, that's kind of the traditional agency model. And for us, like, being at a number of agencies and seeing that work kind of well at times, but also really badly at some places, like, we think it is kind of an insane model to approach the world with now, particularly when we've got the opportunity to speak to people via Zoom calls, via phone calls, via WhatsApp, to immerse ourselves in culture that they're living every day. So we flipped our whole hiring model on its head about 3 or 4 years ago. And everyone from a creative point of view, and this is sometimes quite difficult, particularly from a creative point of view, but strategy planners, they all have to come to the table with no egos. They have to be ready to, like, listen to people.
Good luck with that.
It's been difficult. Like, honestly, like, we've not hired people that we thought are brilliantly talented, but they've not been up for listening to kind of these audiences' ideas and theories on things. And they just want to, essentially, they'll give you this spiel, but then the reality is they'll come down to it. They just want to sit in the boardroom and have their ego tickled and come up with ideas themselves. And that is insane. I'm like, I work on a lot of the creative stuff and I love the ideas process, and there's a lot of brilliant people in our business, from strategists to creatives, but they have to be prepared to not come up with the nugget of gold. They have to take that from, you know, whoever it is from the network and then bring it to life from a marketing capacity, because, you know, these people in the network, they're not marketeers. They don't come up with campaigns or ideas. They just give you something. And then we've got to find out the real brilliance in the people we've got now is identifying that thing and then turning it into something brilliant that the brand can use from a campaign perspective. So that's, I think there's a big shift in the people we employ and how we work with this network and get rid of the egos. we joked around saying no chinos, no egos, but I don't know if that's going to be a tagline or not. But that, in terms of the traditional agency model, like getting rid of egos and just having people come in the business that are willing to listen and collaborate with these people is the way forward for us.
Just a question and push back just slightly. Market research and the marketing industry as a whole has come under pressure over the last, let's say, 5 years, more broadly than sport and entertainment, just purely about becoming detached from real people. And Brexit is the case study. People said, well, they didn't see it coming because actually they weren't talking to those people. They were just talking to people who looked and sounded like them. And so there's a bit of that. And I'm just wondering, there's a bit of your model that suggests, okay, this is a way out of that. That's a good thing. It's a tick here because you're talking to other people beyond the boardroom, and it's not just a Shoreditch-based creative director who is talking to, goes home and talks to other Shoreditch-based creative directors, and they think they're in the real world. So there's that cliche of Adland, and you know, which bleeds into this conversation. My question is whether or not your group of 11,000 tastemakers are representative of real people, or they are just a bigger echo chamber of the same sort of social class and milieu that is the problem. So actually you're just getting a more people saying similar things, and that as a result of that, brands will then start to communicate and they go heavily into purpose, because that's what the group of people that you're talking to are interested in. And actually the bigger group never gets spoken to, because they're not going to be, because they're not involved and they're not interested. What do you think? There's a conundrum in my mind trying to link the two, and I'm not sure whether your model is the answer or part of the problem.
It's a good question to pose this on it.
It is a good question. You've got to say, I don't know if there's an answer, but you've got to say that's a cracking question.
And like fundamentally, again, as kind of hopefully has been clear as we've kind of been speaking about this, like we are really passionate about finding a solution that solves, you know, a lot of the problems that agencies in the industry has had in the past. And I guess, therefore, you know, cracking exactly what you've spoken about there is something that we very firmly had in mind. And, you know, again, we're not kind of the screening process for how people come into the network. It's not how cool is this person, or how culturally relevant is this person. One of the key things that we have within it is to make sure it's representative, like a representative kind of global footprint in terms of the markets, but then also that it has a diverse selection of people. So we do screen, you know, individuals as we select them for collectives to kind of answer client briefs, to make sure that we are getting, kind of a diverse mix that's representative of whatever market they kind of exist within. So that is kind of a factor that we have within it. And then one of the other things that, you know, is particularly important is, or important to us as kind of we tap into these people, is that they are, you know, they are influencing and listening to and speaking to the audiences that are the mass audiences that we want to hit. So they are, you know, really, really in tune with what they want and what they like and what they don't like. And it's that we're trying to tap into. It's not that we're trying to tap into, you know, what do you think about this topic? You know, the conversations are, you know, to go back to the tennis fans in Portland example, you know, that audience group that you exist within, you know, how do they feel about this, and what do they like, and what are they tapping into, and what do they not like? So it's not like we are trying to tap into the exact motivations of the people who are within the network. Part of it is to allow us to punch out into the wider audiences that they have access to or kind of exist within. So I think those are kind of two of the key factors that we kind of have in mind. There is a third, which is that, you know, through this, part of what we do whenever we land on things that are particularly contentious or challenging is to, you know, we do test things at scale still. And, you know, the stuff that you're talking about in terms of tools and platforms that scrape social data at scale, etc. You know, we do align it with data like that to make sure that what we're doing isn't solely based on you know, kind of qualitative conversations. So we are always marrying it up with data that we see in the marketplace as well, to make sure that we are avoiding that echo chamber point as much as possible. And it's an ongoing thing, right? Where you're continually working at how we improve this and how we make it better as we go on. I think those three are the three things that we consistently have in mind anyway, whenever we're thinking about how we develop this, and to make sure we don't fall into that echo chamber point as much as possible.
Like, fan intelligence doesn't work as a silo, does it? Like, we always talk about interpreting and kind of making sense of data as well. And quite often we'll work with big data sets or data agencies or rights holders that have brought data to the table, and like quite often is just dumped in one place or dumped on the brand. We'll like to think we make sense of that, and fan intelligence is part of the solution, and we're not kind of naive enough to think that that's the only thing that kind of gets brought to the table when we're thinking about product innovations or big brand campaigns as well. So yeah, I think Owen's kind of summed it up brilliantly there in terms of how it fits into the mix.
Well, it's interesting because there's a sort of combination of the model. I find the model genuinely interesting because I've not come across it. I've seen variations of it. And as I say, I've seen research that is sort of touching on this. But actually, there's something about the size of the group. But just tell me about you mentioned there about you're in daily contact with them. How does that just work on a practical basis? Without revealing your secrets behind the, in the black box. But how does that work?
So Owen mentioned before, we've got CRM managers that will look after people within the network. And the network's segmented in a number of different ways. So there might be, Owen mentioned the Future Football Collective and people that are wanting to influence and define the future of football and where it's going. It's also segmented by regions as well. So whether that's kind of Southeast Asia, North America, etc. Also by other verticals like esports or tennis, cricket, etc. We've got CRM managers that will each have ownership of those different segments and collectives of audience. And their job is to keep them incentivized, keep them motivated and keep them engaged. So strangely enough, like there's people that if we don't speak to them for 3 days, like in the Future Football Collective, they'll be asking us, they'll be like, they always want to kind of discuss and chat. So there's a strange like two-way thing going on where we're not just like badgering them for responses or answers. Having said that, there's each of the CRM managers has got a different way of keeping those people engaged or motivated. There's things like kind of daily questions that we'll send out in group WhatsApp chats that they'll literally just reply and people will get a spark of conversation. That's actually a product that most of our clients buy. It's so easy because they'll just go, right, I'm New Balance, for example. Nike bring out a football boot. We just want to see what your group of the collective think about the new launch that Nike did. We'll just fire it in and we'll give them some anecdotal responses. And it's just immediate real time opinions from people that really matter. And obviously that's not enough information to build a whole campaign or strategy around, but it's enough for them to immediately go into a meeting with their boss or go into, a meeting with a football club and say, oh yeah, the new Nike boot came out. This is what we're seeing the audience talking about. And the ability to be able to kind of give like real-time insights like that to our clients is a real benefit from it. But yeah, things like that enable it to be just an ongoing resource that I suppose is constantly engaged and they're constantly spoken to as well. So that's kind of a big, I guess, I don't know if that sort of goes some way to answering your question, but in terms of keeping them motivated, engaged, that's a big part of it.
Footballers as influencers. Marcus Rashford is the case study of De Gea, but it's obvious that they've got an enormous profile. And again, you mentioned gaming culture earlier. You can see that actually the sort of that whole idea of being a creator as well as a gamer is bleeding into the way footballers see themselves. What are the limitations of that? Because it's difficult to be a brilliant footballer and not spend all your time training and playing football. It's really hard to, have that career, whereas how much time you can then devote to creating and being sort of productive in a media sense. And I guess the answer is that you'll get an agency to do it for you if you are a footballer. But how do you balance that? How do you keep the credibility, do you think, going forward? Because that's an obvious trend that you're tapping into. And when you talk about cultural relevance right at the very beginning, that is, they carry a lot of that weight in that story. Just wondering how they're going to manage that. What do you think?
The impact of Roc Nation and the Marcus Rashford work and how they've helped guide him and support him in areas that maybe he doesn't have knowledge or areas of expertise or, you know, resource or time on his hands to do. Like having people around, those footballers who know what they're doing and really care about the subject matter that they care about as well. It's just an absolute given that that almost has to happen to provide that support. So I'd say that that's kind of the first thing. But I mean, it's healthy, right, to have other things in your mind other than football as a footballer as well. Like, I think like looking at, you know, not necessarily, although like these guys train quite a lot, like there's a lot of free time on their hands. So whether they're kind of gaming or whatever they're doing at home, like having other things in their mind, I think, should be seen as a positive as opposed to something that is seen as taking their eyes off the ball from a football perspective.
Yeah. And I think just to build on that, I mean, that's something that, you know, we are seeing young players are being encouraged to, I think, to, you know, when they're going through academies to at least have, you know, another interest that kind of helps them from a mental kind of mental health perspective, but then also just in terms of their personal growth. And then you couple that with the fact that young players are growing up, you know, watching and being inspired by, you know, kind of content creators who document their lives. And so, you know, what we're seeing with a lot of them is also that just, you know, that aspect is just something that they've grown up and seen. And it, as opposed to it necessarily maybe being totally another vocation, it's an aspect of just how they, you know, communicate with their friends and then how they, you kind of, kind of want to capture what they're doing on a day-to-day basis. So there's a real kind of base level of this is a generation of football talent or sports talent, sorry, coming through who see that as part of just life. In the same way, I guess, you know, 20 years ago we started to have footballers coming through who saw, you know, fashion and having, you know, yeah, picking up the next, you know, outstanding pair of trainers as being part of their life. This aspect of kind of content creation and documenting what you're doing is kind of being seen by this generation as, I guess.
Do you think Otro, a sort of idea ahead of its time, do you think it was a good idea, but we weren't ready for it? Do you think it's another or a version of it is going to appear that the, you know, that was the sort of the basic thrust of that idea was obviously that the player, the rise of the player as a publisher and, you know, to provide a platform, you can make your own decisions whether it was successful or not. But that was the same thread, same basic insight that you're talking about there. Do you think we'll see that appear again in a different form?
Personally, I think it would be surprising if it doesn't, because if you take a look at Otro and I guess the audience insights that would shape why that, you know, why people would love that are definitely still true. Of like to your point of like audiences want to have that view of players, that, you know, yeah, kind of that additional perspective and into their lives and lifestyles. And players are, you know, increasingly coming through who are I guess more comfortable to feature in and create and be part of that type of content. So it would be really weird if that in some form doesn't happen again or happen in a different way, because the pieces all seem to be there. I guess it's, you know, building it in a model that lands and that, you know, everybody's kind of enthused by and wants to be a part of. But it feels like the audience insights that would make it interesting are definitely still true and probably will continue to be. I guess it's whether, you know, players want to retain even more of the control of that themselves, as opposed to being part of a bigger network.
Yeah, I've not seen it's been done. There's a couple of other examples that spring to mind around Otro, maybe ahead of Otro being coming to fruition, and just the commercial model and trying to necessarily believe that a platform like Otro is able to move fans away from where they're currently consuming lots of content or, you know, their stuff that they consume. They consume it in places that they're on their phones on a daily, on an hourly, on a kind of minute by minute basis. And I suppose I can see why the insight does build to that as an idea. And you can see why kind of a lot of private equity has been invested in that area, because in a lot of ways it makes sense. And the potential from a media perspective is huge in terms of the value of that. But I think, you know, it's one thing kind of getting some investment money, and then it's another thing actually turning that into a real platform that has that generates like commercial value on a regular basis. And I think like it's an extremely difficult proposition. I think when you look at where people are currently consuming a lot of that content and a lot of where audiences are, trying to move audiences off their regular platforms is just next to impossible in a lot of scenarios. So yeah, it won't be an area that I think Ear to the Ground are going to create some IP or moving into, but I think I'm sure there'll be other businesses, and we've seen some that are actually on the verge of kind of emerging in the next 6 months actually, that definitely will rise. But I think it's a really difficult area to tackle, and obviously Otro like was an amazing idea, and I think dependent on, they could have gone different ways with certain executions of that, but potentially wouldn't have changed the outcome. I'm not sure. It's one to speak to Simon Oliveira about and the guys, but yeah, it was a fascinating idea and some great stuff that happened around that.
Right, we're going to finish there. We're going to push it into the future a little bit, but just in terms of brands, and you can't name your own brands here, okay? No, I will ban a client list at roll call. Just give us an idea of companies or brands that are doing interesting work, stuff that you think, okay, well, that's what other people will copy. There'll be, or just things that have caught your eye that you think are deeper than just the sort of cycle of just work coming and going. What do you think, Owen?
This is something that's just in my mind because they're having a client salad this morning. Was the direction that Netflix have kind of taken over the past 18 months as a brand, slightly longer, where they've, you know, really taken, and this isn't specifically in sports, so I've just diverged immediately into another space. But, you know, we've all seen the issues that Hollywood has kind of had from a kind of representation perspective, and the fact that it became, you know, there's a lot of pressure, quite rightly so, being put on, you know, the big studios and organizations in Hollywood to essentially tackle that problem. And there was a lot of, you know, umming and ahhing about how it could be done and who was responsible for it and how the bodies could help. And Netflix took a stand on that on their own and, you know, made a big statement that they were going to tackle it within and, you know, tackle it head first and changed, you know, they made a positioned a great vision for what they were going to do, made it really clear what they stood for. And then they applied that in terms of how they shape their teams, but then also the creative output, and then their comms as well, to consistently reflect the vision of being more representative of society and taking ownership for that. You know, they didn't kind of let that slide into something the industry should fix. They tackled it head first, and you know, we're seeing the result of that in terms of the creative output now from the shows that they've got, but then also, you know, some of the additional kind of initiatives that they've got in place. I think that kind of bravery and boldness is really admirable, and I guess is something that's, you know, set them up particularly well for the next you know, year or two going forward. I appreciate I've gone straight out of sport.
Rich,
that was going to be the one. Me and Owen were both just prior to this. We're working on something that the Netflix example has been something that we've heralded as best in practice, and just creating that vision that. Like brands are so risk averse, aren't they? Like rights holders even more so. And like brands like Netflix that can just go, you know what, like we probably should like road test this a bit, make sure that there's no kind of issues with going out with a message like this. But actually, you know what, like they just want to sit on the right side of history, and they want to have a vision that, like, fair enough, they might turn off at some of their customers or some of their audience, but do they really want to be associated or have those people kind of call themselves Netflix customers anyway? And the answer is probably no. So like there is an element of like brands that are seen to be taking a risk but are sitting on the right side of history. And I'd say Netflix, like in the work they've done around diversity and inclusion in the sort of film media space, is so powerful. And yeah, hopefully other brands kind of like take note of that and really, you know, I don't think it's a risk sitting on the right side of history around diversity and inclusion. But strangely, like brands kind of still think it is. And for me, that's the kind of crazy thing that comes out of the Netflix example, that there's not more brands doing that.
Republicans buy sneakers too. That's the, you know, that's the the idea, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, listen, I've really enjoyed that. And thanks very much for your time. And we've covered a lot of ground. If people need to get hold of you, how can they do it? Just look at the website, I guess.
Yeah, call Owen.
He hasn't got much to do.
Yeah.